This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Hugh Herr, sometimes jokes that he feels sorry for people who have both legs because those legs can't be upgraded like his can. Herr had both legs amputated below the knee after getting frostbite during an unexpected snowstorm while mountain climbing. That was back in 1982 when he was 17. Now he walks on robotic prosthetic legs. As we'll hear, they do things that his intact legs never could have done. He expects that their capabilities will keep improving, and he can say that with authority since he helps design them. Herr has worked at MIT's Leg Lab and Media Lab and now directs MIT's Biomechatronics Research Group. He's the holder or co-holder of 14 patents related to assistive devices, including a computer-controlled artificial knee. One aspect of prosthetics he's focusing on is how amputees can control the movements of their robotic limbs by signals from their nerves or brains. Herr is one of the people profiled in the new book about innovative technologies developed in MIT's Media Lab. The book, The Sorcerers and Their Apprentices, is by former Media Lab director Frank Moss. Hugh Herr, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe the artificial legs that you designed that you're wearing today?
The legs that I'm wearing today, they're called Powerfoot Biomes, and they're an ankle-foot prosthesis. So my legs are amputated below the knee, about 6 inches. So from there down to the floor, I'm artificial. I'm titanium, carbon, silicone, a bunch of nuts and bolts. My limbs that I wear have 5 computers, 12 sensors, and muscle-like actuator systems that enable me to move throughout my day.
How do you activate the computers? Like, if I want to move my foot, I just think, move the foot, and it moves. How do you get your foot to move?
Well, in the future, I'll have neural implants within my biological body. But for now, the artificial limb itself has its own intelligence. So when I push on it and when I change its positions, it responds in a natural way. So when I want to walk faster, I simply walk faster, and the artificial limb outputs the right torques and energies.
Did you design the computer part, or did you have computer specialists come in for that?
My laboratory at MIT, what we first do is we model how the human body works in standing, walking, and running, what the muscles are doing, what the tendons are doing, how the muscles are controlled with spinal reflexes. And that biological science motivates what we build. So we end up with putting forth novel architectures of how motors interact with springs, interact with sensors, interact with onboard microprocessors. So we do most of the design work of the artificial limb.
So you described the limbs that you're wearing today. Do you have other artificial lower legs at home that you wear for other occasions?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a running pair. I have a bionic walking pair. Limbs that are waterproof. I have various limbs for climbing mountains, summer, descend steep rock ice walls. Spiked feet that penetrate ice walls, other feet that wedge into small rock fissures, others that stand on small rock edges the width of a coin. So probably about 8 pair or so.
Wow. I think it's amazing that you can still do all those things that you mentioned, climbing mountains, climbing ice with your artificial legs. Are there things your artificial legs can do that your real legs couldn't have?
Oh, absolutely. My legs were amputated in 1982, and I quickly realized that from the knees down, I was a blank palette for which to create. I could create any type of limb that would afford me various physical capabilities. So I quickly realized that, well, if I want to climb a mountain, I could make my artificial limbs very, very lightweight, lighter than human flesh. So I used carbon composites with a density much, much lower than that of flesh and bone. But I had the same strength in my upper body, so I could do more pull-ups before fatiguing. When I climb a steep ice wall, I no longer have calf fatigue. When I'm on my front points, it feels like I'm standing on a sidewalk. It's fantastic.
You know, I like this idea that your prosthetic legs can keep getting better and better and designed for all kind of specialty needs, while our real limbs get more worn out with age. So yours can improve.
Absolutely.
When real ones tend not to after a certain age.
Yeah, it's interesting because my biological body will degrade in time due to normal age-related degeneration. But the artificial part of my body improves in time because I can upgrade. I can get the best computer, the best motor system, the best artificial intelligence. So I predict that when I'm 80 years old, I'll be able to walk with less energy than is required of a person that has biological legs. I'll be more stable. I'll probably be able to run faster than a person with biological limbs. So it's quite interesting that, in fact, my artificial part of my body is, in some sense, immortal.
Yeah, that's kind of amazing. Now, are you wearing shoes over your artificial feet?
I'm now wearing my bionic walking limbs, and yes, I do have shoes on. But when I climb mountains, I do not use shoes. The sticky climbing rubber is attached right to the prosthetic foot. I need not use a mountain boot.
And why are you wearing shoes now? Is that for so that people don't stare at you?
Just to try to attempt to fit into society.
Right. Do you ever wear shorts and just like let the prosthetics show?
Oh, absolutely. It's a lot of fun. So in terms of industrial design, the approach that my team takes is as follows. We want the bionic limb to have a human-like shape. But we don't want the bionic limb to look human. We want it to look like a beautiful machine, to express machine beauty as opposed to human beauty. And the reason is we want the user one evening to, you know, pull a black sock over their bionic limb and have their limb appear to be fully biological. And then the very next evening go to a fancy party where they pull that sock off and they expose the fact that part of their body is bionic. So that interplay between human and machine beauty is something we accelerate and allow.
So in talking about machine beauty, how would you aesthetically describe the beauty of your artificial legs?
Well, we all know of machine beauty. We have beautiful cars. Some people find the Mercedes a beautiful machine. It's certainly not a human beauty. It's a machine beauty. Many of us find the iPod, Apple products that are so well designed, beautiful. Again, not a human beauty, but a machine beauty. So what we want is we don't want the user of these prosthetic limbs to be ashamed of their body, ashamed of the fact that part of their body is artificial. We want them to celebrate it. So to do that, we need to put forth synthetic structures that are elegant.
You started needing artificial limbs when you were 17 that you had your accident?
Yes, the tender age of 17, that's correct.
Tell us what happened.
My climbing partner at the time, Jeff Batzer, we traveled to New Hampshire to climb Mount Washington. It was January. We headed up towards what's called the Huntington's Ravine. And we climbed about a 700-foot ice face called Odell's Gully. When we got to the top of the face, we decided to continue towards the summit of the mountain. And the weather conditions became more and more severe. The snow was blinding. The wind speeds were very, very high. We could barely stand. So even though we ventured just a few minutes above the top of the face, we were not able to make it back. We were not able to retrace our tracks and return to the same gully system. We mistakenly descended down what's called the Great Gulf region of Mount Washington, and it's the wilderness side of Mount Washington. And it was there that we spent several days trying to stay alive, digging snow caves, hugging each other to stay warm. Through that process, we made it to within just a few miles of a roadway of civilization. But at that point, we were no longer able to walk. We suffered some severe frostbite and hypothermia, and we, because of the frostbite, we could only walk a few paces for, before losing our balance and toppling over. Fortunately, a person was out snowshoeing for the day, discovered human footprints, our footprints, followed them to our snow cave, and we were rescued from the mountain via helicopter.
Did you think you would survive and before you were rescued?
No, I didn't believe that we would make it even one day, and we made it nearly 4 days. The conditions were severe. It was minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit, snowing continuously. The average depth of snow was to the waist. So sometimes the snow came up to our chest. We could barely move. So I thought we would freeze to death the first night. But it turns out by hugging one another, by sharing body heat, we were able to survive for quite a long time. But near the end, when we were both not able to walk even three paces before toppling over, that's when we both gave up hope. And we actually stopped hugging each other. And our strategy was the sooner we die, the better. We were in excruciating pain.
So when you were rescued and you found out that you would live, but then you found out that your legs were going to be amputated, what went through your mind in terms of that mix of the positive side knowing that you'd live and the negative side of knowing that you would never physically be the same again?
Well, our physical condition to me was the least of my concern. We were plucked from the mountain, and we were told immediately that a rescuer had died, a volunteer rescuer, Albert Dow.
Rescuing you?
Yeah, he and a partner were in Huntington's Ravine, and while descending, they were hit by an avalanche, and Albert perished. So the news of that was just horrible, horrible. You know, I really, at that time, I really didn't care what was happening with my physical body. I was just devastated that a fellow climber had perished.
I can have some sense of how devastating that must have been. When you did find out, when did you find out that you would be losing your legs? Did you know that before the surgery, or did you wake up and find that they were gone?
My medical team spent several months trying to save my biological limbs. There were periods where I would have two surgeries a week, where they would go in, they'd try to clean the tissues to restore circulation to my lower legs. But those efforts did not work, and on mid-March of 1982, both of my legs were amputated. I was aware going into surgery that I would come out of the surgery without feet. When I woke from the surgery and I looked down at my legs, I was shocked at how high the amputation was, how short my legs had become as a result of the amputation. So that was very traumatic for me.
The amputation eventually changed your life around because you found your calling, which is designing artificial limbs. But before finding your calling, did you go through a period of abject depression?
Yeah, immediately after the accident, I was very, very angry with myself, putting myself and my partner in that situation, as well as other climbers. And someone ended up getting hurt. Someone ended up dying. So I wasn't really depressed. There was a severe, intense anger, and out of that anger came this extraordinary swelling of energy, and a desire to not wallow in self-pity, but to do something worthwhile with my life. I viewed at the time that to give up, to wallow in self-pity, would have been a disgrace to the memory of Albert Dow, the rescuer who had died.
Would you describe the first prosthetic legs that you were given what they were capable of doing and what it physically felt like to wear them?
After my legs were amputated, I was home in a wheelchair for a month, and then I was sent to a rehabilitation center. And at that center, I was fitted with my first prostheses. The prostheses were made of a plaster of Paris, and they actually told me to not walk without canes because the added force of walking without canes may actually fracture the plaster. So the devices were very, very crude. And I remember distinctly, I was in a wheelchair. They put these artificial limbs on me made of plaster. And I pressed up on parallel bars with arms fully extended. And then I slowly put weight on my legs. And I never felt such excruciating pain in my life. I think I stood there for a second and immediately sat down again.
And was that because the amputation was recent, or is that because of the nature of the prosthetics?
More the former than the latter. When a limb is first amputated, as you can imagine, it's very swollen. It's very, very sore, the residual limb. And then to actually stand requires that very high forces and pressures are exerted on the residual limb. And that's often done very early before the residual limb has fully healed. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine how painful that is. But after a while, after 6 months, after 12 months, the residual limb takes on a uniform volume, a uniform shape. It doesn't atrophy in time. Then if the prosthesis is fit well, it can actually be reasonably comfortable.
Did you get to the reasonably comfortable point?
Yeah, it took about a year. It's very interesting as an amputee, the more experienced one is as an amputee, the better it gets, the more comfortable the prosthesis becomes, because that residual limb is a constant shape, and the skin becomes conditioned.
At what point did you think about designing a better version of the prosthetic leg?
The prostheses that were provided to me were designed for the horizontal world and for walking very, very slowly on a horizontal surface. They were not designed for fast walking, for running. They were not designed for the vertical world of rock and ice climbing. After the accident, I dreamed of returning to my chosen sport of mountain climbing. So it immediately became apparent to me that what I needed to do is design my own artificial limbs. So I had training in machining and carving metals and woods and making artifacts. So I went into the shop and I started grinding and cutting and designing various limbs, designing various foot structures that were conducive to the vertical world of rock and ice climbing.
What was the first prosthetic like that you designed?
Well, very early, initially I put a rock climbing boot over the prosthetic foot, and then I said, well, that's silly, and I threw out the shoe. And then I realized, well, the foot need not look like a human foot. So, you know, to climb a vertical rock face, I really don't need a heel, so I cut off the heel, prosthetic heel. It was just extra weight that I didn't need. And I started then optimizing how the angle of the foot relative to the calf of the prosthesis, the size of the foot. I made my rock climbing feet are the size of baby feet. They're very, very small, very, very short, so I can get the center of my body over my feet on a vertical wall. So through all this tinkering, I was actually able to climb at a more advanced level after my accident with artificial limbs than I'd ever achieved before my accident with normal biological limbs.
This might be a silly question, but if you're in the vertical world and you're climbing a mountain, that's putting a lot of pressure, isn't it, on the join between the prosthetic limb and what's left of your leg? I mean, what prevents you from falling off of your own prosthetics?
Falling out of my own legs?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is that a stupid question?
Not very much. So what was absolutely terrifying was the threat of my prosthetic foot being wedged so tightly in a rock fissure that I would not be able to get it out. And then about a minute later, my arms would fatigue, and then I'd, you know, fall, and eventually my stuck prosthetic foot would catch me. And then since the connection between the artificial limb and my body isn't that secure, I would simply fall out of my own legs. So then I'd have to be at the bottom of the mountain after falling, and I'd look up, and there'd be an artificial limb stuck in the crack hundreds of feet up. There's a funny story. One time I fell, and the ropes eventually caught me. But right after the rope caught me, I slammed into the rock face, and it was with such a force that one of my prosthetic feet broke in half.
Oh, God.
And it tumbled down the mountain. And at that early point, I was still wearing rock climbing boots. And we yelled down to a tourist at the base of this rock wall as they walked by in their hike to please find the boot and put it next to our backpacks at the base of the wall. So this tourist went over and they grabbed the boot and they said, "There's something in it."
So if that accident happened and it was to your real leg, what would have happened?
Probably my tibia would have just been shattered into many, many, many pieces.
So in a way, you survive better with the artificial limb than you would have with the real leg.
Oh, gosh, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I can walk through high grass and not have any fear of snakes. I would love for a snake to try to bite me. If they would get a mighty surprise.
So one of the things you could do with your artificial legs is change their height. So tell us some of the ways that comes in handy for you and why you would choose one height over another.
My brothers are they're 5 foot, about 10 inches. And with my artificial limbs, I'm about 6'2", 6'3". So just, in day-to-day life, I've augmented my height.
Why did you want to be taller?
It's fun to be tall.
I wouldn't know.
There's social advantage to being higher in stature. In climbing, sometimes the hand and foot holds are very, very far apart, and it's advantageous to be tall. Sometimes the handholds are very close together, and it's actually better to be shorter. So when I climb, I look up in the rock face, and I kind of decide, depending on how the face looks, what height I should be and what foot I should use and whatnot.
So you can adjust the height as you're wearing the prosthetics.
Yeah, it's just a simple turn of an Allen key, and I can be as short as 5 feet and as tall as I'd like.
Wow. And have you used this to trick friends?
Yeah, my first several weeks in undergraduate school, I decided to conduct the following experiment. Every day I went to school, I increased my height by 1 inch. So I wanted to see how long would it take for someone to notice that I was increasing in stature. And I think I got up to nearly 8 feet tall, and I had to touch the ceiling practically to remain balanced. And someone finally said, "You seem to be getting taller." And I said, "Of course, college is a growing experience." One can have so much fun with artificial limbs.
What have you done to try to make the limbs as comfortable as possible? We've talked a lot about function, but just in terms of like comfort in the join between the flesh and the metal.
When my first patent was issued while I was in undergraduate school, and the patent described a way of connecting the artificial limb to the human body mechanically. It described using fluid bladders that surround the residual limb and that are sandwiched between the outer part of the artificial limb and the human body. and the user could vary the pressures within these bladders and whatnot. So that was kind of my first design project. Today at MIT, I have an entire team working on novel ways of connecting artificial limbs to the human body, where the material, using an onboard power supply, the material will stiffen or would become soft depending on whether the person's sitting or standing or running. So when a person sits, the interface will become soft and loose with very little pressures. But if the person suddenly gets up and starts running, it'll stiffen.
Well, it has to be so smart to be able to do that.
Yeah, many, many, many sensors and small microprocessor across the interface. So yeah, there's a lot of intelligence.
Do these legs cost a fortune?
Yeah, they're currently too expensive to be made widely available across the entire world. Artificial limbs are generally affordable in places such as the United States. But a country, for example, like Afghanistan or Cambodia, there's no way that a person there would be able to afford the limbs. So that's something we long-term that we working in technology and business need to do a better job. It's just because I was born in the United States and into a wealthy country affords me the best medical devices, and that shouldn't be. We should have a system set up where we could have broad application and distribution of these types of mechanisms.
You said earlier that one of the things you're hoping to accomplish with your artificial limbs is to find a way where they can be neurally connected to you so that you can think, move, and they will move. How in the world are you thinking about going about doing that?
You know, I predict that as we march into this 21st century, the changes we'll see in prosthetic designs, that the artificial prosthesis will become more intimate with the biological human body. There'll be emergence, if you will. So there's several forms to that emergence. One is that the prosthesis will be attached to the body mechanically by a titanium shaft that goes right into the residual bone, wherein you can't take the artificial limb off. Another intimate connection will be electrical. The nervous system of the human will be able to communicate directly with the synthetic nervous system of the artificial limb, if you will.
How? I mean, I just can't imagine how that could possibly be done.
Well, there's a number of research groups worldwide developing what are called neural implants. For most persons with limb amputations, they would have what's called a peripheral neural interface, which would comprise of small electronic packages that are implanted into muscle in the residual limb to measure the degree to which the muscle has been activated electrically by the spinal cord. And there'd also be small electronic packages attached to nerves. When a limb is amputated, obviously key nerves are transected or amputated. So in the future, there'll be electronic packages that communicate in a bidirectional way with the amputated nerve. They'll measure motor information, how the person wishes to move, descending commands from the spinal cord, and there'll be stimulation ports to stimulate the nerve endings to reflect the sensory information from the artificial limb onto the human nervous system to close the loop between the human and the machine. One day, amputees will not only be able to walk across sand, but they'll be able to feel the sand against their synthetic prosthesis.
What you're describing seems so just totally far out, but I mean, the fact that you've accomplished what you have so far makes me think, well, maybe maybe it's really possible.
Yeah, when you look at prosthetic innovation over history, what you'll see is spikes in innovation during and after every major war.
Mm-hmm.
So World War II, for example, there's a tremendous progress in prosthetic design. The current conflict that we now find ourselves in Iraq and Afghanistan, we're now seeing a tremendous innovation spike. There's several reasons for that. One is there's a lot of funding now from the U.S. government to fund research in this area of science and technology. Another reason why it's an interesting time is that over the last several decades, key disciplines have matured that are relevant to prosthetic design. Robotics, tissue engineering, artificial intelligence. And we now find ourselves in a position that if we cleverly integrate these disciplines, we can put forth truly bionic limbs that fundamentally improve the quality of life of persons with limb amputation.
Well, it's nice to have such hope for the future for people who have amputations, and I'm sure this would also apply to people who don't. I'm sure eventually this technology will help people who haven't lost limbs, but maybe
Absolutely.
Are just like weak or in pain, or you know, need an assist of some sort, or elderly people. Like, what are you working on now that would apply in those areas?
Yeah, so our conversation has been about prosthetic limbs, but we're also working here at MIT on exoskeletal robotic structures. And that's a robot that wraps around a biological limb. And that biological limb could be impaired or it could be completely normal and healthy. So in the former case, when the biological limb is impaired due to age-related degeneration or due to stroke or spinal cord lesion, given a few examples, the robot pushes on the impaired biological limb in just the right way to allow a person to stand, walk, and even run. We're also working on exoskeletal structures that augment human capability beyond what nature intended. So fancy pants, these robots that you wear on your legs that allow you to run with less stress through your biological leg, allow you to walk and run with less energy, food energy. We predict in the future that when a person, for example, goes jogging, they'll routinely wear robots. Why? To protect their joints, their knees joints and hip joints and whatnot from the risk of injury. And if you have a knee injury, you'll wear robots to protect your joints from further degradation.
You know how a lot of older people use walkers because they're either too weak to walk without an assist or they have a hip problem or a leg problem? Can you envision robotic technology that would make that, you know, by comparison, primitive walker obsolete?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it could be in a form of, again, an exoskeletal structure that wraps around the legs of the elderly person. Or it could be implants. It could be implants into key muscles within the leg that help the nervous system of the elderly person fire the muscles in the appropriate way for balance.
Why do you still climb? You were in a horrible blizzard. You came so close to dying. You lost the bottom of your legs. You lost your feet. Somebody died trying to rescue you. You felt really guilty and angry at yourself. And you designed these artificial limbs, which in part have enabled you to keep climbing. Why would you go back to it after such catastrophe?
Well, I've been climbing mountains since the age of 7. To me, it's it's as natural as walking. Climbing is a vertical dance. It requires both physical power and also grace, graceful movements. So it's always been a part of my life. It's absolutely exhilarating and wonderful, and it's something that I didn't want to give up, and it was really the first expression of how I could exploit technology attached to my body in a way that was positive and that would help others.
Did you ever climb that mountain again, the one where you got lost and got hypothermia and frostbite?
I have, yes, and I have two daughters. They're 6 and 8 years old, and my daughters have climbed the mountain as well. So it's wonderful to now see them ascending these glorious mountains that I ascended when I was young as well.
Well, Yuher, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure. I wish you well, and thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Yuher heads the Biomechatronics Research Group at MIT's Media Lab and is one of the people profiled in the new book, The Sorcerers and Their Apprentices. You can see pictures of him wearing his prosthetic legs on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new film, The Help. This is Fresh Air. The film adaptation of Catherine Stockett's best-selling novel, The Help, opened today. It's set in the early 60s, at the dawn of the civil rights era. The story is told from three different points of view: two African-American maids working for white families in Jackson, Mississippi, and a young white woman who wants to write about them. The film was written and directed by Tate Taylor and stars Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer as the maids and Emma Stone as the writer. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Few fictional films wear their political messages as proudly or loudly as The Help, which centers on black female domestic servants in Jackson, Mississippi, in the early 60s, and a 23-year-old white woman who induces them to tell their stories for a book to be called, appropriately enough, The Help. Emma Stone plays the perky white woman, Eugenia Phelan, nicknamed Skeeter, who returns from college to find her wealthy family's maid, who essentially raised her, gone under mysterious circumstances, and her friends married with kids and black maids of their own. After Skeeter talks her way into a newspaper job, ghostwriting a column on housekeeping, a subject about which she knows nothing, she reaches out for advice to her friend Elizabeth's maid, Abilene, played by Viola Davis. But as racial tensions intensify and her snooty friends reveal their true segregationist selves, Skeeter prevails on Abilene to give her more than household cleaning tips.
Something else I want to write about. I would need your help. I want to interview you about what it's like to work as a maid. I'd like to do a book of interviews about working for white families. And we could show what it's like to work for, say, Elizabeth.
You know what Miss Leafall would do to me if she knew I was telling stories on her?
Well, I was thinking that we wouldn't have to tell her. The other maids would have to keep it a secret, too.
Other maids?
Well, I was hoping to get 4 or 5 to show what it's really like in Jackson.
Getting those other maids turns out to be a problem until the insults become even harder to bear. The imperious Hilly Holbrook, played by Bryce Dallas Howard, announces it's unhygienic to let black people use their house toilets and directs her friends to build outhouses. Then Hilly dumps her aging mother's maid, Minnie, played by Octavia Spencer, for being what's often called sassy. Although Medgar Evers has just been murdered and the KKK is on the prowl, Minnie finally agrees to talk to Skeeter, too, but not before laying down the law.
All right, I'm gonna do it. But I need to make sure she understands this ain't no game we playing here. Slide your chaplain under that table. Face me. I need to see you squelm at all times. to come up with your questions too?
Oh. Let's begin with where you were born.
Belzona, Mississippi, on my great auntie's sofa.
The Help is based on a novel by Catherine Stockett, both beloved for opening wide eyes to the vantage of maltreated servants and attacked in some quarters as a white author's appropriation of black women's experience. Some of Stockett's critics have gone so far as to say she actually romanticizes domestic servitude by depicting black nannies' genuine love for the white children in their care. They also say the novel is full of stock characters that reinforce classic African-American stereotypes like the sassy maid and the shiftless, abusive husband. My view of this controversy is easily stated. I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. I concede the novel and movie are heavy-handed, but I also think they're full of good evocative details, closely observed depictions of the coping mechanisms of both servants and employers. The white Southern belle's passive aggression, condescension, and sheer misuse of power come through vividly. Director Tate Taylor has a dull, square style with too many close-ups, but the faces we get close to are great ones. Emma Stone is amazingly vivid, at once blurty and brainy, and villainous Bryce Dallas Howard lifts her nose and slits her eyes with a plum. Jessica Chastain plays a handsome rich guy's hot, uneducated wife who hires Minnie on the sly to teach her how to clean and cook. The character has been simplified. In the novel, she's scarily unstable. But Chastain makes her helplessness hilarious. Allison Janney triumphs over countless banalities as Skeeter's oblivious mother, and Sissy Spacek has some funny scenes as Hilly's mom, derisive toward her daughter, even in her dottiness. Octavia Spencer's Minnie is indeed a stereotype, but she charges into the frame and gives her scenes a lift. The center of the Help is Viola Davis, who has eyes unlike other actresses. They're hard, unyielding, with no give-back, softening only for the neglected little girl in her care. It's a tough, beautifully judged performance. The weak, weepy, uplifting ending is odd, given Mississippi's imminent eruption. But there will be wet hankies everywhere. The Help is the highest form of middle brow.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can watch clips from the film on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.